Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. It's a nice turnout. My name is Sebo Astanyan. I am the Richard Hovhannisyan Chair in Modern Armenian History here at UCLA at the Department of History, and I welcome all of you. Today, I'm going to do something slightly unusual by taking maybe about 7 or 8 minutes of your time and giving some contextual remarks to situate and ground the very interesting talk of our visitor. And I say so, and I think I'm somewhat justified in the topic in which, about which I will be speaking for about 8 minutes, given the fact that we are within very close proximity to the commemoration of the Armenian Genocide only 2 days ago. So the great crime of genocide, in all of its enormity and complexity, has cast a long and dark shadow on Armenian identity and scholarship. As a result of genocide trauma and state-sanctioned denial of this event, many Armenians around the world have succumbed to what I have called elsewhere, following the work of the great Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges, the Funes el Memorioso effect. Borges, let us remember, brilliantly explores the perils of being crippled by a bloated memory of the past in his fascinating fictional tale Funes el Memorioso, where the central protagonist one day falls from his horse and instead of suffering from amnesia becomes a repository of the whole world's memory. Unable to filter out anything from his memory, Funes becomes a living encyclopedia of all the events, sensations, moments, and so on that have taken place since the beginning of the universe. His memory is disabling. I am probably not alone in thinking that the continued denial of the Armenian Genocide has created a hypertrophied or Funes-like bloated historical memory for most Armenians that has held them captive to a tragic chapter of their past. Even more vexing is the fact that in some narrow circles, the trauma of the genocide has lent itself to shoring up a politics of exclusionary nationalism and has contributed to making suspect attempts by scholars to emphasize the cosmopolitan, hybrid, cross-cultural, and connected aspects of Armenian identities and histories, especially where Turks and the Islamic world are concerned. One cannot and should not underestimate the heavy burden of the post-genocide trauma on the writing of Armenian history, and I would in no way wish to suggest that this dark chapter in history should be bracketed in any attempt to do a critical stock-taking of Armenian historiography. However, as understandable as the post-genocide fixation with maintaining identity and emphasizing the survivalist meta-narrative of Armenian history may seem, it should not come at the expense of precluding interest in other kinds of histories and identities, ones that involve mixing and mingling, in short, métissage, with other cultures and traditions, including especially Muslim or Turkish ones, in which Armenians in the past have also been engaged. Perhaps nowhere has the dead weight of the genocide and its continued denial been more damaging than in the way Armenian scholars have looked at and interpreted the history of Armenians, in the Ottoman Empire and the Islamic world in general. Here, for understandable but unfortunate reasons, the hypertrophied memory of genocide has produced what Salo Baron, the historian of the Jewish diaspora, in a different context called the lacrimose conception of history, with all its attendant insular narrative. On the whole, the trend has been to emphasize the miseries, hardships, and persecutions of diasporic life for the Armenians, especially those living in the various domains of the Ottoman Empire, long before specific military, diplomatic, ideological, and other conjunctures in the last decades of the 19th century forever transformed Armenian life. This lacrimosity has resulted in sketches of Armenian Ottoman life that downplay creative cross-cultural interactions between Armenians and members of other millets of the empire and has produced at times a simplistic image of Ottoman Armenians who are, as it were, left undisturbed in their national essence. The latter are either in the position of perennially resisting the corrupting Turkic and Muslim influences, and thus remaining purely Armenian, or alternately, they are seen to be behind some of the greatest achievements of the empire. In either case, what is often downplayed in Armenian scholarship is not only how Armenians creatively interacted with Turks and other members in what was, after all, a large multi-ethnic, multilingual, and religiously diverse empire, but also how they were embedded in Ottoman society and culture, and as such shared many of its norms and values, and even actively participated in creating such norms. Vartan Pasha's writing of the first Ottoman novel in Armeno-Turkish is a good case in point, about which I'm sure our speaker will later on inform us. Against the all too powerful urge to project backwards into Ottoman history assumptions and realities associated with the genocide, and especially post-genocide history of Armenians and Turks, we must stand steadfast, I would argue, as historians, and seek areas and times in the Ottoman past where both Armenians and Turks, as well as others, partook of cross-cultural interactions with relative freedom from violence and destruction. This brings me to today's speaker, who will be addressing the theme of cross-cultural interactions between Armenians, Turks, and others in the Ottoman Empire by focusing on perhaps that most hybrid of things Ottoman-Armenians created during the last several centuries of the empire's history, and perhaps even earlier. That is to say, namely, their mixed and cross-cultural hybridized language of Armeno-Turkish, which is basically Ottoman Turkish written in Armenian script, as I'm sure many of you already know. Murat Cankara studied physics and mathematics for 2 years before majoring in theory and history, in theory and the history of theater, and receiving his PhD in Turkish literature from Bilkent University in 2011, with a dissertation entitled Empire and Novel, Placing Armeno-Turkish Novels in Ottoman-Turkish Literary Historiography. His PhD research focused on novels written by Ottoman Armenians in the Turkish language using Armenian script between 1850 and 1870. Apart from making a critique of the historiography, Cankara argues in his dissertation that the authors of the early Turkish novels in Armenian and Arabic scripts appropriated different and at times conflicting features of Western Romanticism. Cankara is generally interested in the histories of literary cultures of the 19th century, and particularly in the birth of Turkish and Armenian novels. Tensions between literary romanticism and realism, cultural encounter among Ottoman millets, the appropriation of Turkish by Armenians, historiography of Ottoman literature, print culture in Ottoman Empire, and theory of humor are also among his areas of interest. His interest in Armenian culture began with the script and the photocopies of three Armeno-Turkish novels he got from the Armenian Patriarchate in Istanbul the day the late Hrant Dink was assassinated. Eventually, the script carried him over to the language and history. He recently completed a year as a Manoogian postdoctoral fellow at the University of Michigan's Armenian Studies program, where he taught a course on Armeno-Turkish, and is currently in the process of writing a comparative article using concepts such as vernacularization, cosmopolitanism, language, and violence. So without further delay, join me in welcoming Murat Cankara. And please turn off your cell phones. I forgot to mention that, just in case.
Thank you. Please warn me if my voice goes down while I'm talking, because sometimes I lose myself in what I'm talking about. Can you hear me now? Okay. So before I begin, I would like to express my gratitude to the Richard Hovhannisyan Endowed Chair for Modern Armenian History at UCLA, UCLA Department of History, Gustav von Grunebaum Center for Near Eastern Studies, and to Professor Sebu Aslanian for providing me this great opportunity and for his introduction. I will try to build on that actually. Some things I will repeat. And thank you to those who have come here to spend your precious time listening to me. It's truly exciting to be here. In this talk, I'll try to demonstrate how and why the Turkish language written in the Armenian script, that is what we call Armeno-Turkish basically, might have served as a written lingua franca among different ethnic, linguistic, and religious groups in the Ottoman Empire, among the Ottoman millets, and possibly the others, especially throughout the 19th century. First, I will very briefly point out to the general problems of what we call the Ottoman millet system in literature. Then I'll present some basic information on Armeno-Turkish. This I'll follow by examples of some 19th century Turkish notables, writers, statesmen, who either knew Armeno-Turkish or were aware of writing Turkish in the Armenian script. Finally, I'll speculate on a simple question in order to place all this into a broader context and open up a debate on the issue of cultural encounter among the Ottoman millets. Why would Turks be interested in Armeno-Turkish? That will be the question. First, the millet system and cultural encounter. I'll not go into the details of the millet system here. There is significant literature on that. But I find Karin Barkey's definition useful. She calls it an ad hoc procedure for the organization and integration of non-Muslim religious communities into the empire. So it's not a system to begin with. It was retrospectively called a system, as Benjamin Brode has shown. The most comprehensive work on the issue is a two-volume study edited by Bernard Lewis and Benjamin Brode. And here's a quote from the introduction, which I find very significant. Probably the first that strikes the visitor is the medley of peoples. It's in the strictest sense a medley, for they mix but do not combine. Each group holds by its own religion, its own culture and language, its own ideas and ways. As individuals they meet, but only in the marketplace, in buying and selling. There is a plural society with different sections of the community, living side by side but separately, within the same political unit. Even in the economic sphere, there is a division of labor along racial lines. This I find very interesting for a number of reasons. It's taken from a travel account on South Asia, but the editors argue that this applies well to the Ottoman Empire. So they begin with this. Indeed, it's quite easy to find similar descriptions of the cosmopolitan centers of the empire in the mid-19th century. Travel accounts, especially, or missionary accounts. Medley, compartment, ghetto, race, Tower of Babel are very popular terms in these accounts. Now, I would first like to argue that this literature on the Ottoman millet system hinders our understanding of cultural encounter among these millets. In other words, we are not only in trouble with post-Ottoman nationalities which are fighting for their national cultural boundaries, but also with this as a historiographical problem. Here are some of the reasons I find it problematic. It's excessively political. It's written from a judicial perspective. Class differences within the millets are ignored. Primary non-legal sources are not historicized. Non-textual means of cultural encounter are ignored. Language and script barriers are overrated. I won't go into the details of all these. So maybe this can be interesting, taking into account Professor Aslanian's introduction, because this judicial perspective and being judicially autonomous somehow turns into being culturally autonomous or isolated as well. So the borders are very strict, just like in the case of millet's political autonomy. This one, class differences within the millets ignored. In the literature, there is a tendency to talk about millets as homogeneous communities. So there is not, we can find a tendency to think that there are differences between different clusters of these communities. So to think that there was no cultural encounter at a general level is something else, but to think that there might have been encounters among certain levels, among the elite, notable, is something else. That's what I mean. There are examples of that. One thing is that these non-legal sources are not historicized. If you take them from the missionary accounts and travel accounts, you see these medley and mixing but not combining arguments, but nobody historicizes this argument. So why would these European missionaries, or missionaries or European travelers, would see a society like this when they came to the cosmopolitan centers of the empire? This is a problem. Why would they always speak of races? Why would they speak of unique identities? Why would they speak of communities not mixing? That's a problem. Here today, I'll take the final one. And I'll try to show how script barriers were more permeable than we assume through Armeno-Turkish. That'll be my case. So, what is Armeno-Turkish? Turkish language written in the Armenian letters, characters, or script, mostly written by and for Armenians whose mother tongue was Turkish. Catholic Armenians, Mekhitarists, and Protestant missionaries play an important role. These are three pieces of information you can find almost anywhere. Mostly religious texts written in vulgar Turkish, not widespread, not Armenian, not Turkish. Again, these are more like a consensus. You can find these almost in every mentioning of Armeno-Turkish. I'll try to show that these are true, all of these, but wrong at the same time. That's very interesting. And with this, not Armenian, not Turkish, this is interesting as well, because two decades ago, as far as I'm concerned, there was Armeno-Turkish would not be called a contested heritage or patrimony. I mean, people would not fight over incorporating or appropriating Armeno-Turkish. This is Armenian, this is Turkish. But now things began changing, because Armeno-Turkish is now associated with more popular concepts in modern academia, which makes it a fashionable topic. I now begin hearing people saying, oh, this is Armenian, of course. Oh, no, this is Turkish, because it's written in the Turkish language. So in that sense, there is an interesting case. When I began writing my dissertation, there was no mentioning of Akabi Hikayesi, the first novel in the Turkish language, in modern scholarship. But when I submitted my dissertation, it was on Wikipedia. Vartanyan's novel is the first Turkish novel, of course. Okay. So if you ever would like to do research on Armeno-Turkish, these are the terms you will come across. Hayadar Türkeren or Türkeren. Dutch Geren in certain texts, Armeno-Turkish, Armeno-Turk. There is no consistent terminology in the archives. You find many, many ways of referring to the phenomenon. Sometimes even you see examples where Armeno-Turkish is thought as a separate language, like Armenian. They would use it instead of Armenian, or would say that this is translated from Armenian. You find the text, it's not Armenian, it's Armeno-Turkish, but they would call it Armenian, which is interesting, a study topic on its own. Why? One of the most important questions, why Armeno-Turkish? I don't need to go into the details of the relationship between the Armenian script and Armenian national identity. It's you probably know the invention of the Armenian alphabet is considered as one of the three most important events in the Armenian history. Some argue that Armenians throughout history survived thanks to the Armenian alphabet. It was kind of ethnic boundary maintenance to use the Armenian script for writing the Turkish language. The difficulty of writing and reading in the Arabic alphabet, you can find it in many contemporary and modern sources, because you couldn't show the vowels in the Arabic alphabet easily, and if you didn't go through the traditional educational system, it was almost impossible to read and write in the Arabic alphabet. The tension between classical Armenian and modern Armenian, for example, in 1852, Josef Vartanian, he wrote this Armeno-Turkish history of Napoleon Bonaparte. In the preface, he makes an excuse for writing in Armeno-Turkish, and the excuse is, I have to write this in Armeno-Turkish because modern Armenian as a language has not developed yet, and I have to borrow from Krapar in order to be able to write, and not many will understand it. So I write this in Turkish so that many Armenians and many people can understand this. A practical solution for those whose mother tongue was Turkish, this, as I said, has to do with the second one. So this has to be worked upon. But the idea in this is the following. If you know the Armenian, if you haven't been through the traditional education system of the Ottoman Muslim Turks, you can't learn reading and writing in the Arabic alphabet. But if you're already with, I mean, if you go to church, and if you're already familiar with the Armenian alphabet, it's a very practical solution to put these together. You see this in many examples, because Armeno-Turkish does not have to do with printed works only. You find, I mean, people writing notes in their notebooks, poems in their, on the pages of their books. So it's a practical combination in that sense. You use the script you're familiar with to write the language you already speak. The last one, again, needs further study, but this is something interesting. People who work on Armeno-Turkish or on the reasons of appropriating and using Armenian alphabet for writing the Turkish language neglect the material aspect of Armeno-Turkish. What I mean is this. In the 19th century, when Muslim Turks began printing their newspapers in the 50s, 60s, Armenians had been printing for hundreds of years, which is very important. If you take into account the economy of things, the finding of the typesets, the type founders, you know, as a profession. So even a very preliminary research into the Ottoman archives gives you clues about this. You know, we need these letters. Where can we find this? Where can we borrow these Latin letters? Because we have problems with the Arabic. So I'll add two things here. Missionaries and larger audience. The missionaries, as I'll show, used Armeno-Turkish to appeal to a larger audience, which is very important in the use of Armenian script for writing the Turkish language. And then Armenian language instruction, which is very important. We see that Armeno-Turkish plays a role as a transitory role from passing to the Armenian language. Because the first Armeno-Turkish printed book, which was printed in 1727, which was written by Mehitar, was the grammar of modern Armenian language, written in Armeno-Turkish. And you can still find examples of that in 1897, let's say. A modern Armenian grammar in Armeno-Turkish. This is a very important role. Okay. Basic facts taken from Hasmik Stepanyan. So manuscripts date back to 14th century, printed works date back to 18th century, the press dates back to 19th century. We're talking about over 2,000 books, nearly 400 plays in Armeno-Turkish, staged by Armenian groups, over 100 periodicals, 200 printing houses, 50 cities. One problem with the bibliography and with studies is that we don't know the circulation numbers, or it's very hard to specify the genre. I mean, what are we talking about exactly? But again, we have a general idea. This is taken from a PhD. Somebody put all the data using Excel. So among all the Armeno-Turkish publications, religion is almost one third. Literature plays an important role. Linguistics and education are also important. You'll see the reasons for that, I hope. These are Armenian-Turkish publications through 19th century. You'll see the drastic increase, especially in the 1850s, 90s, and then the fall. This is the time when we talk about the formation of a literary market in the Ottoman Empire, which again is very important from the perspective of Armenian-Turkish, because here I'll show you examples how Turks' interest in Armenian-Turkish will begin increasing, and the reason for it will begin changing. Now, in the third part, I'll focus on Turks who knew the Armenian alphabet or who were aware of the Armenian alphabet, as I said before, and we'll try to convince you that this script served as a common tool for written expression among different groups. This is one of the earliest examples I came across while trying to find out Turks' interest in Armeno-Turkish or in the Armenian script. Eremya Çelebi Kömürciyan, at the behest of learned Turks, also translated into their language excerpts from the history of Horenatsi. This is by Mikhail Çamcıyan. This manuscript exists. I'm still working on it, so this is Armeno-Turkish. This is written by Eremya Çelebi Kömürciyan, and the argument is that he wrote it for some learned Turks who wanted to read Armenian history. Who these Turks are, we don't know. Now, 1830s, James Ellsworth Dakey, an American zoologist who stayed in Constantinople between 1831 and 1832. He came to the capital together with his father-in-law, who was commissioned by the Sultan Mahmud II to supervise the reconstruction of Ottoman navy. Then he printed his memoirs in 1833. It may be added that few Turks are acquainted with Armenian characters. He just even gives it a subtitle. I mean, he finds it interesting, but then who these few Turks are, again, we don't know. But we can assume that he met some notables, just like in the case of Eremya Çelebi Kömürciyan, because he came there with Henry Eckford, and he was meeting with some notables and statesmen, as we understand from the memoir. 1840s. This is taken from a report published in the Missionary Herald by the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. So apparently there was a fair in Balıkesir, today Western Turkey, where merchants and tradesmen from all parts of Asia Minor and other parts of Turkey, including Syria, gathered for purposes of trade. And apparently Armeno-Turkish religious books were very popular. So, I mean, I'm aware that missionaries' representation of the locals should be, I mean, taken critically. I'm not using missionary accounts as the only source, but this is interesting. There are many examples like this. So the Turks of the place also manifested a considerable interest in Armeno-Turkish books. And then the author goes on giving examples of one Turk who got both the Armeno-Turkish version and Greco-Turkish version, and then he couldn't read it easily because probably he was learning the script. Which again is interesting, to learn the script for reading religious books as something worthy of consideration. Now, so until around the 60s, let's say, or mid-19th century, one can say that we have more or less anonymous examples, in the sense that we don't know who these Turks are. We just understand that they are either notables or converts, as in the previous example I showed, or who were about to convert to Christianity. Moreover, it's not hard to see the Protestant missionaries. I mean, that they give an impetus to Armeno-Turkish. By the 1850s and 60s, though, we begin sensing a little change in the situation. What is the change? So this is Miftah-ı Kıraat-ı Huruf-ı Ermeniye fi Lisan-ı Osmani, key to reading Armenian letters in the Ottoman language. 74 pages, no date of print, probably around 1850s. Johann Strauss argues that it was printed around 50s, and it makes sense taking into account the language. The preface of this book is quite interesting. According to the author, the single most important function of writing is to inform human societies of the affairs and circumstances of the others, other nations, thereby breaking the limitations on this international dialogue and turning it into a general one, as if there is only one nation in the world. He also refers to the change of societies and competition among societies, but he was mentioning breaking the barriers, that he was mentioning the script's role in this, informing nations of the affairs of the other nations, and the idea of one nation is very, very interesting. Then, as usual, he emphasizes the difficulties of the Arabic alphabet and argues that the Arabic alphabet hindered the spread of Turkish written in the script among the different groups of the empire. And he presents his manual as a solution to this problem. I mean, so he thinks that the Arabic script with the Turkish language cannot serve as a lingua franca for the Ottoman Empire's different groups, but Armenian script can. And finally, he says that he wrote his work upon the request of a majority of Ottoman notables who wanted to learn the Armenian alphabet because it was much easier to read with. So this is the first page of the book. So you see the pronunciation of the letters in the Arabic, but he had to use hareke because this is the idea. You can't give the vowels with the Arabic letters, which is ironic. Outline of a grammar of the Turkish language as written in the Armenian character by Elias Riggs from the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. This was published in 1856 in Istanbul. It's a pamphlet, 56 pages. Again, the difficulties caused by writing Turkish in the Arabic script is underlined, but this time there is something different, a different emphasis in this manual of Armeno-Turkish. Riggs suggests that Armeno-Turkish is especially valuable to a beginner in the Turkish language. So this is clearly not intended for Turks. We can assume that he wanted to simplify or accelerate the process of learning Turkish of his fellow missionaries, which makes sense, and we have evidence for that. Missionaries learning the Turkish language in order to address the locals. So it was much harder and time-consuming for them to do the same with the Arabic script. Moreover, it was possible to access spoken Turkish through Armeno-Turkish, which was not possible through the Arabic script. His argument makes us think that the book might also be addressing non-locals and non-missionaries. Here, what I mean is this. If we take into account the influx of travelers, merchants, statesmen, missionaries, orientalists to Ottoman cities, cosmopolitan centers, throughout the 19th century, it's easy to imagine how this pamphlet could have been useful for those who at least wanted to learn the basics of the Turkish language, the spoken one. So, I mean, as of 1893, there were almost 200,000 foreigners in the Ottoman capital plus Izmir, Smyrna. This is something we have to take into account, I guess. Ali Suavi is one of the most prominent political figures of the 1860s and 70s of the Ottoman Empire. He was a member of the Young Ottoman Society, and this is
the journal of the society, which was printed in Europe. Now, all journalists, you see that many learn foreign languages and read foreign newspapers. Nowadays, how much those who know French, or those who at least learn the Armenian script, learn about the affairs of the state and the nation? Those who know only Turkish cannot know about this. This is a very interesting statement. 1867, we understand that nowadays people are learning the Armenian script to read news about what was going on in the world, foreign affairs. And if you read the whole article, there is something else which is interesting. Ali Suavi, in this short piece, is making a call for writing in vernacular Turkish, which implies that Armeno-Turkish was a model vernacular for the process of what we call simplification of Turkish language, but somehow do not say vernacularization. Basiretçi Ali. Basiret is the name of the newspaper Ali published. It was published between 1870 and 1878. It was arguably the most influential and best-selling Turkish newspaper in the 70s among Muslim Turks. Ali Suavi, Namık Kemal and Ahmet Mithat, whom I'll be mentioning, wrote in this newspaper. It's said to have had a circulation of nearly 10,000, and arguably the most advanced printing technology when compared to the other periodicals in early 70s. Now, this is important because here Basiretçi Ali makes a direct quotation from an Armeno-Turkish newspaper. The other day I saw an article in the 386th number of the Armeno-Turkish newspaper named Oragir. Since its content shows the fanatic ideas of its author, and since he proves his idiocy with his services to his nation, I have hereby quoted in verbatim and written the necessary reply underneath. He makes a quotation from an Armeno-Turkish newspaper. There is a harsh critique and insult in this quotation, as you can see, but this highlights another function of Armeno-Turkish for Muslim Turks, which I'll come back to. Namık Kemal, the Turkish poet, journalist, one of the leading members of the Young Ottoman Society. He is known as the father of the homeland, as you may know. This is taken from a letter to his son-in-law, another prominent literary figure of the time. The discussion is on the reforming of the Arabic alphabet, which has to do with Armeno-Turkish as well, the need to reform the Arabic alphabet, because the idea begins to emerge that reading Turkish in other alphabets seems to be much easier. They can do it in a week, whereas we can teach reading and writing in the Arabic alphabet hardly in a year. That's the idea. So he says, even the Greeks and Armenians in our country would not agree to study and write with the European letters, because the Greeks and the Armenians letters are certainly 1,000 times more perfect than the Latin letters. The discussion was about the need to change the letters. If that necessity is agreed upon, then what we need would be adopt either the Greek or the Armenian letters, not the insufficient Latin ones. So this is not, I know, that the direct evidence that he knew Armeno-Turkish, but at least the idea that Turkish could be written better with the Armenian letters implies some awareness of what was going on, or a knowledge to a certain extent, which I find significant. Ahmet Vefik Paşa, the Turkish statesman, lexicographer, and translator who is known as the first promoter of theater among the Muslim Turks. He is famous for his Molière adaptations. Now, Cyrus Hamlin is another American missionary from the Board of Commission for Foreign Missions who founded the Robert College and today the Bosphorus University. In his memoir, My Life and Times, he mentions Ahmet Vefik. I presented a copy of the arithmetic book in Armeno-Turkish to Ahmet Vefik Efendi when he was Minister of Public Instruction. He seemed greatly interested and said it was just what the Turkish schools needed. and he would get hold of the Armenian character and transfer the book to the Turkish character. Now, this is important because the book, we learned that it was published and it was sent to schools. Now, we cannot be sure if whether Ahmet Vefik Pasha learned the alphabet himself or commissioned somebody else to do it. But this gives us another clue as to the function of Armeno-Turkish for Muslim Turks throughout the 19th century, which I'll come back. And Ahmet Vefik's potential knowledge of Armeno-Turkish is no marginal case because he was extremely influential on the later generations. Not in the theatrical sense. His interest in lexicography is very important. If we build a connection with Armeno-Turkish dictionaries and their relationship to phonetics, and his collaboration with Armenian theater groups in Bursa when he was the governor of Bursa, which implies another connection.
Bless you.
Ahmet Mithat Efendi, by far the most prolific man of letters of the last quarter of the 19th century Ottoman Empire among Turks, and one of the most influential literary figures on later generations. Now, if one is, he wrote a piece in the journal he published, some information on writing. He gives account of writing systems throughout history. If one is to examine the existing scripts, one would see that the most excellentish, he uses the word excellentish, mükemmelce, one is the Armenian one. Because with the Latin characters, not even those languages which descend from Latin can be written properly. In short, it's known to its connoisseurs that the Latin alphabet is totally inadequate for German. The Greek alphabet has even more shortcomings than the Latin one, and the Armenian alphabet, when compared to these and to others, is rather an excellent one. Now, this is important because this is not an argument he can borrow from the European sources that were available to him at the time. He knew French, and we know that he would read French encyclopedia, the Larousse, and sources written in French, and then he was a kind of encyclopedist, and he would turn them into short pieces for the Turkish Muslim audience, and in those sources, Armenian alphabet is not the alphabet he's talking about. There, in those sources, if you're looking for a perfect alphabet, it's the Sanskrit, not the Armenian. So, it is very probable that this argument has its roots some in practical knowledge. If you continue, you'll see more clearly. The simplest way to measure an alphabet's excellence is to write another language with that alphabet and then make someone who does not know that language read it. If he can read it properly, one can judge that the alphabet in question is efficient. Today, the Armenian script has this power to some extent. This sounds like very much Armeno-Turkish. And of course, in his novels, there are other references to Armeno-Turkish, and we understand that he knew Vartanyan, Josef Vartanyan, he knew Akabi Hikayesi, he knew Armeno-Turkish publications. Add to it the fact that his most famous novel was printed in Armeno-Turkish.
Felatun Bey ile Rakım Efendi. Okay. Halit Ziya Uşaklıgil.
In Ottoman Turkish historiography, literary historiography, Halit Ziya is generally referred to as the father of modern Turkish novel. Now, what is not mentioned in most cases is that he is a graduate of a secondary school founded by Mekhitarist priests in İzmir, Smyrna, which he says shaped his intellectual identity. So, at some point in the memoir, this passage, out of its place, comes. There was an old but robust priest with his whole tall height and upright posture, who managed the school library and laboratory. One day, he saw me reading Mr. Antanik's book on physics in Turkish and said, if you knew Armenian letters, you would find here many Turkish books written in this way. I must have looked so confused at him that he left me there once and came back with a huge volume after 5 minutes. This was a very good geography book written in Turkish but with Armenian letters. He explained the Mehitarist publications. Now, This anecdote, as I said, stands somewhat out of place in the narrative, as he provides no further commentary or elaboration on it. He might be glossing over the issue, we understand, because the memoir was published in 1936, at a time when Turkish nationalism, I mean the efforts to define or event or even invent Turkishness and to draw its solid borders, what was at its height. And Halit Ziya is the champion of the literary movement, which was criticized for by national authors for being non-national and rootless. So he's trying to prove that he was Turkish. He even begins the memoir by saying, yes, Uşaklıgil, I come from the center of Anatolia. Okay? But then why is he talking about Armeno-Turkish out of the blue? Ahmet İhsan Tokgöz, author, translator, and one of the foremost Turkish publishers around the turn of the century. He published the famous journal Servet-i Fünun, the Wealth of Sciences, the journal published between 1891 and 1944, almost without any interruption, was a gathering place for the young supporters of a new literature. Before I began to understand French as I wished, I clung onto the newspapers and novels published in the Armenian script in Istanbul because I had learned the Armenian letters from my Armenian classmates in a few sessions. I could read perfectly well Manzume-i Efkar and Ceride-i Şarkiye, Armeno-Turkish newspapers, which were printed in Armeno-Turkish. I read most of Montepin's crime novels in the Armenian letters. Armenian arithmetic and geometry books were useful for me even at school. We had no printed notes for our classes. We would take notes from our instructors and thus go to class, which gives us other clues about the functions of Armeno-Turkish and the change it's going on with. It's even more interesting. In Istanbul, all sorts of periodicals would mushroom and then perish in those years. They would all start off with pages full of ghazals, rubais, kasidas, and eulogies, and would not leave the old style. As I had learned the Armenian letters, I saw a bi-weekly journal named Cihan, which was published in Armenian letters but in the Turkish language. It would mimic the European style. I liked its articles on science, literature, and economy. I wrote articles for Cihan for quite a long time. So he not only read Armeno-Turkish, he wrote Armeno-Turkish. Osmanlıca bilenlere 4 günde Ermenice okumanın usulü. The method of reading Armenian in 4 days for those who know Ottoman Turkish. When I came across this title, I was shocked in the library. I said, oh my god, I have to find this. So I've been spending my months, years for the language and it can be done in 4 days. So it turned out that what he meant was Armeno-Turkish. As I said, it was being referred to as Ermenice, Armenian. Certain instances. This is a very interesting pamphlet. It's something like 14 pages. It was printed in 1892, written by Hacı Beyzade Ahmet Muhtar, who later taught Armenian in the School of Political Sciences. On the back cover, it's announced that an Armenian calligraphy notebook is bound together with the pamphlet. I didn't see that. If you occupy yourself, as far as you have time, with this book, which was commissioned to my impotent authorship, be sure that you'll be able to read Armenian, again, Armeno-Turkish, in 1 or 2 days. This book will not only show the easiest way to those who want to read newspapers, illustrated weekly periodicals, novels, etc., written and printed in Armeno-Turkish, but can also be considered, again, a guide in their own language to those who wish to learn the real Armenian language. Again, it's all there, you know? Reading newspapers, novels, and then transition to the Armenian language itself. So, after the 1880s, there seems to be a trend among Turks to learn the Armenian script for an easier access to French literature. I mean, the formation of a literary market, as I showed you in the graphic. the translation of bestsellers into different scripts of the empire, like Eugène Sue's bestsellers in the Greek script, Armenian script, Arabic script, which is it's a topic in itself, a dissertation topic, the comparison of those texts. So generally, the Arabic script version would come after the Armenian, but there are certain times when the Armenian script version comes after the Arabic script version. For example, Ahmet İhsan, whom I showed before, he was known as the translator of Jules Verne. So after he translated Jules Verne into Turkish in the Arabic letters, 2 years after, an Armeno-Turkish version came. So the comparison of all these would be an interesting study. Moreover, with the establishing of public and mixed schools, the modernization of education, the instruction of Armenian language in certain secondary and higher education institutions seems to have contributed to this growing interest among Turks in Armeno-Turkish. What I mean is that the necessity of textbooks. You need textbooks after a certain point, which makes Armeno-Turkish very appealing, because there are already textbooks in the Turkish language, and also novels, of course. And the good thing is that you can learn the Armenian script in 2 days, whereas you have to learn another language at least in 2 years. Now, the question is not why would Turks be interested in the Armenian script, actually. The question is this: why wouldn't more Turks be interested in the Armenian script? You know, because in all over the place you find examples, oh, I was craving for books, so there was this bookstore, I bought them all, but then I mean it finished, so I was waiting for new books. But then if you learn the script in 2 days, you can double the texts available to you, which makes it very appealing. You can learn it from a classmate after 1880s, like Ahmet İhsan did. The long-term trends, if we take into account the examples I showed you. So first we have the anonymous examples of the notables. And then we saw the missionaries. In the 60s, 70s, press comes in, and to learn more about what was going in world politics becomes important. And then after the 1880s, literary market, the translation of bestsellers, modern public education, the need for textbooks come. So this is something to be worked upon, this transformation, you know? It's waiting there. Okay, this is the, do I have time?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm about to finish. Why would Turks be interested in Armeno-Turkish? The crucial question. I've tried to write down some of the functions of Armeno-Turkish for Turks, which are almost completely derived from the examples I showed you. Political surveillance was one of the important functions, as the quotation from Oragir, Basiretçi Ali, he was criticizing this Armenian author for his politics and making a quotation. And there are other examples. For example, the arguably the first cartoon ever appearing in a Turkish newspaper was a caricature of an Armenian author who was the editor of an Armeno-Turkish newspaper. So probably they read and they made fun of him because of his ideas, because he was claimed to be a spy. The need for textbooks, I've shown an example, it speaks for itself. In the Ahmet Vefik Paşa case and also Ahmet İhsan case, it was very easy, apparently, to find an Armeno-Turkish textbook, and also in Halit Ziya's case, of course. It was easier to find one in Armeno-Turkish. I can't imagine myself being at a distance from a textbook where there is none available other than that, and the distance is just 2 days. So that's the idea behind it. Easier access to French literature and world politics and news is one other function. The formation of a literary market. Debates on the Arabic alphabet seems to have caused the development of interest among some Turks in the Armenian alphabet. You can see examples in early 20th century. So, especially on the way to Romanization of the Arabic alphabet, you see some statesmen interested in writing systems of the world. How would they write their language? This Arabic alphabet seems to be failing us. It doesn't work as we wish. So, what do the Armenians do? How do they write Turkish? What do the Greeks do? How do they write Turkish? There are examples for that. As in the case of Ali Suavi, it was very important with respect to vernacularization because there was already a model of written Turkish in the vernacular, in the Armeno-Turkish case, where in the Arabic script you can find that. Especially if you look at the novels, Armeno-Turkish novels, you'll see that there is a great difference between the Turkish used in those novels and the Arabic lettered novels which would follow them. So that's a very important point, I guess. Quest for a non-Western model of modernization. This is not something we take seriously, I believe, in historiography of the Ottoman Turkish historiography. But when you read carefully the sources, you see that at some point this question comes up. What are the local Christians doing? How are they dealing with these problems? With education, for example. So we're looking at Europe as a model, but it seems that our local Armenians are doing a better job when compared to the Europeans. So the implication is that we should not follow them, but them, because it's closer to us. It's local yet modern. Theatrical production is something I would like to work upon more. So one of the things which would interest 19th century scholars is this development of what we call Turkish theater by Ottoman Armenians, mainly. Like in the case of Tiyatro-i Osmani, the Ottoman theater by Agop Bartovyan, Güllü Agop, in the 1870s when he got the monopoly for staging plays in Turkish. So he has a group of actors and directors, and 80% of them are Armenians, and 20% not. So the general question is there. I wonder, how would the actors memorize their parts? I don't think it makes sense to do it in the Arabic letters in many cases. Indeed, 2 months ago, a book was published in Turkish based on a dissertation by Yervant Mano Baret. He worked on Armeno-Turkish plays staged in San Lazar. He gives transliteration of 3 Armeno-Turkish plays from the late 18th centuries, which are very interesting. The language, the themes, but also in many of the versions he underlines that there were blank lines. So the actors would not write the whole play. So what would the, for example, Muslim actors do in the Ottoman Empire when they acted in a play? How would they memorize their lines? That's an interesting question. Lexicography. We see in the examples that this is a very important aspect of Armeno-Turkish, because in certain dictionaries, like in bilingual, trilingual dictionaries, you see that Armeno-Turkish was used as a phonetic script to give the pronunciation of the French word or the English word, because you can't do it with the Arabic script, which is again an interesting case. And type foundry, I think I have mentioned that. So this was what I have planned for today. Thank you for your patience. I left some examples and some other things for the discussion and questions and answers. Thank you.